3, 2, 1.
A lot of the things that I used to write about, I wouldn't see that way anymore. I'm going to grow and I'm going to evolve. And I think, I mean, I've always been super optimistic, but I think there was a bit more of a kind of like sarcastic or cynical edge that I had. People love to feel, you know, like vindicated for their resentment. I think the hard thing about in between times is you don't know what the parameters are. Can we say the day the pandemic began? No, it could be the first day that I had to stay inside, the first day that restaurants closed. And then what will be the end? It's not going to be one day. So this past year has been really hard because it's like we're longing for something that we don't even know what it looks like.
Mari Andrew is a writer and illustrator who has been inspiring me and others for years. Her illustration career started as a hobby in 2015 as a form of self-expression. She combined her reflections and some watercolor on paper to document her stories. I came across her Instagram page in 2016 while we were both living in Washington, D.C. We both now live in New York. Her way with words and colors are a source of comfort to an online audience of over a million. She shares stories with us about grief, relationships, heartache, friendship, trying careers on, illness, and real self-love. In 2018, she released her New York Times best-selling book, Am I There Yet? The Loop-De-Loop Zigzagging Journey to Adulthood, and 1 year later, she released a guidebook to go along with it. Most recently, she has published her latest book, My Inner Sky, on embracing day, night, and all the times in between. Even though she started the book pre the pandemic, it is the perfect book for this moment as we all need a little more encouragement for, quote, present thinking. She's also become a hospital chaplain, something I'm very excited to talk to her about. Welcome to this guided storytelling session of Podcast Noir with Mari Andrew on the healing process of writing, how to share almost everything with everyone, what she learns from people taking their last breath, turning a hobby into a career, and much, much more. Mari Andrew. I'm not going to lie to the audience. I just had an interview with you kicking off your book tour a few days ago, and it was spectacular, and we did it way past our bedtime, and it was so fun. I kind of want to debrief with you. Like, how did kicking off your book tour with me that night go, and how has it been?
Oh, well, you were definitely the highlight. That was a weird day. It was a weird day.
It was a weird day.
It felt like things should be happening that weren't happening because we can't do them. You know, it felt like, wow, I just worked for 3 years on this book and I'm just sitting in my kitchen alone, like waiting for this virtual event to start. And then as soon as you close your laptop, it's like, oh, all right, that happened. And what I want to do is like talk to you backstage and have a little party and debrief and talk to people afterwards and mingle and all that stuff. And it's like, you know, you give a lot of energy to a screen. And then once you're done, it's just like, oh, okay, there's nothing else.
And then you just go back to your room. And also that was your publishing day, which is like major. I feel like there's going to be a big handful of authors who published or were supposed to go on tours during quarantine. And that's just going to be such a unique experience. I wonder how we will reflect on it in the future. But our conversation today isn't really about the future. It's about present thinking, which is what I really appreciate about your new book, Inner Sky, which is what I want to talk to you about today, because your book and talking about present thinking with you is what I've been really reflecting on for the last week. Before we get into that, I want to ask you, like I ask you every time I talk to you, how is your heart?
My heart is good today. It's good today. I think I was really disappointed the past couple days to not really have the fanfare that I was hoping for when I wrote this book a couple years ago.
I love that you're so honest about that. Thank you for sharing that, because I know that's hard to share.
It is hard to share because I am perfectly aware that it's such a gift. I'm tremendously fortunate to be working during this time, to be able to produce something that during this time, which our culture really values. And, you know, there's some self-worth stuff wrapped up in there. But, you know, at the end of the day, it is something, an accomplishment I didn't get to celebrate. And I know there are, you know, bigger problems out there, but I want to honor that because I think probably most people are mourning kind of minor things. You know, it's like we're all experiencing this very big spectrum of, you know, personal pandemic experiences. And I want to, of course, honor all of that. But I think probably a lot of people are in the boat where they're just really disappointed over like little things like parties. And you have to remember, those are the things that make life so fun and so beautiful. And as you know, I've started work in a hospital. We can talk about that later. And I'm with patients a lot. And the things that patients really miss about their life is parties and taking a bath and doing their makeup and wearing clothes. It's not like these profound things, you know, these profound revelations that they're having. It's really like the little things they're missing. So that makes me feel a little better about my disappointment. It's real.
Yeah, I mean, the little things that make us us. And one of the not so little things that makes you you is that you have been writing pretty much all your life. You knew you wanted to be an author from 5 years old, but you didn't become an illustrator until you were 28. And you actually started illustrating while writing your first book, Am I There Yet? Which I think is an awesome encouragement for people who want to turn something that's a hobby into a career, because you did just that. I would love to know about how your relationship with writing got started.
That's a beautiful question. I always kind of felt like I didn't belong in the world. Like I felt like there was something went wrong with the, like, even as young as five, probably starting at five, because that's when I started school, which was kind of a traumatic experience for me. It was so scary and alarming to be around all these kids who seemed to kind of speak a language that I didn't. I was an only child. I didn't really spend a lot of time around kids, and I didn't really know how to be with them. I just felt really different from other people in a way that I can't describe. I think it was probably, you know, really hypersensitivity, just like extreme sensitivity to everything. And so things would make me cry or things made me scared that didn't seem to bother other kids. And so I kind of had this intuitive feeling of like something's really different about me. Like it seems like everyone is doing fine in this world and I'm not. This is not the scene. Like there is too much scariness out there. There's too many things making me sad. And writing was a companion through all of that. I think writing was, you know, if I felt like I was on my little island and everyone else was on this continent, I felt like I was building a bridge to that continent. And through writing, I was able to, you know, really be with these very overwhelming feelings. I could talk about them in ways that were sort of playful and fun. I wrote lots of little poems when I was a kid that talked about feelings as, oh, you did?
Yeah, I have my first poetry book. I actually wrote a poem this morning at 3:43 a.m. My first poetry book is this peach color with this flower and polka dots on the cover of it. It's a spiral book. And I wrote my first poem with a green glitter gel pen, and it was called The Sun, and I was 7 years old.
Yes. Yes, I love that, and I want that book.
I'll send you photos of the poems. It's funny because I've started to think about it again as I've been writing more poetry lately, and my mom actually has been asking me to work on writing with my 10-year-old brother because he has amazing stories and an amazing imagination, but is struggling a little bit with putting sentences together as a 10-year-old does. Mm-hmm. And I realized poetry is such a great place to start because it's so accessible. I relate to what you're saying about growing up. And I remember my love for poetry was something that I had to keep to myself because I got made fun of liking poetry when I would share it, even all the way like through middle school. So I actually didn't like outwardly talk about writing poetry until I was 16 years old. And then I started performing poetry and now I'm bringing it back. It's like such an art. Do you remember what your poems were about when you used to write them?
They were all like so sentimental and emotional. It probably sounded like a really emo teenager or like a wannabe like romantic poet from the 1800s. They were all like, I look out my window and this is what I see and this is the feeling it gives me. And they're kind of like parodies of themselves, really.
Did anyone read them?
No, I don't think so. Maybe my mom, but I think even then I kind of knew it was a little too much. It's like, this is a little overboard. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Do you still have your poetry journals or your
maybe
journals?
I mean, I'm sure. Yeah, somewhere in the closet. I'll have to dig them out.
You have to do that. You have to like get to know that person. That's something I've been doing a lot lately is like watching old home videos and trying to get to know my 6-year-old self is like the one that I see all the time.
Yes.
And it just makes so much sense now. Everything makes so much sense now.
I love that. I feel like the more we become ourselves as adults, the more we become our inner child. Like that's kind of what it is.
Totally.
It's like coming back to that, peeling
back
all of
the layers.
Which
is like the purest form of yourself.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's amazing. And I also know that while you were writing as a little kid, you used to love characters like Matilda and Harriet the Spy and Anne of Green Gables, all of these little girls who had their own worlds. And I loved all of these girls too when I was young. I want to ask you, in that world, for you, what did it look like?
My little inner world.
The world that you created.
I mean, that is one of those things that I would love to go back to, you know, just to see the world through these eyes that were just so full of wonder. And I think even the really overwhelming emotions I had, I think the reason why they were so overwhelming, now I'm learning this through therapy, is I didn't have the words for them. And when you have a word for how you're feeling, it helps so much. It's what's that like phrase in therapy? Like if you can name it, you can tame it or something. It's like this little quip that therapists say. And I think when you're really young, and maybe all children feel this way to some extent and some just kind of cope with it in, you know, different ways. But I felt like these feelings were so intense because I didn't know what they were and I didn't know how to really articulate them. So even feelings like nostalgia, for example. I used to read like the American Girl doll books and feel like kind of overwhelmed reading them. Like, oh, what is this feeling of like, I'm missing this thing that never happened to me.
Yeah.
I'm realizing, oh, wow, that there is a name for that. And I think my inner world was like, I think the magic of it is that I didn't have the societal adult words for things. So I could think about them in my own way. And there's something like so sweet about that. And that's with children's literature. I love adult writers who are able to kind of capture that. Like these kids who don't quite know the vocabulary for what they're going through because they're experiencing it for the first time. I think there's something like so potent there. And like, it's a really special time that I, you know, in some ways I would love to get back. And then, of course, having the resources that I do now as an adult to go back there and see the world like that, you know, without the vocabulary and the constructs to really make sense of it in this very adult way.
Would you ever write a children's book?
I would love to.
That's like on my dream to-do list.
Me too. I think I've got to kind of cook for a while. I think I need like some more time. And I think probably writing children's literature is so difficult that you have to be an extremely good writer. Like writing simply is the hardest thing to do.
I know. Or you just have to talk to a lot of kids.
Right. Like, and I don't know any.
I have some that you can borrow. I have my siblings
okay,
that you
perfect.
Can borrow.
Perfect. Send them over.
My youngest brother is 10 years old and talking to him and just following his imagination is one of my favorite things to do. Sometimes I call him when I'm
just going through a creativity tiff and I'm trying to figure out what I'm thinking and I ask him what he thinks about it. And I take him so seriously because it is the purest form of thought, in my opinion, like a kid's imagination, a child's imagination that hasn't gone through like all of the levels of insecurity that are given to us by pressures of society. It reminds you of like how we're supposed to be. I really, really love that.
Yeah, beautiful.
You've been so generous with your story sharing, more generous than most people I know truly. And you do it with such grace and art and color, and you make millions of people feel less alone. And I know you know all of this, but you talk about anything from difficult relationships to grief to figuring out what your next job is going to be to dealing with an abrupt illness and simply asking the question that so many of us ask, which is, am I there yet? How did you end up getting so comfortable with sharing the most personal and intimate stories some of us have ever read?
Ooh, that's a great question. It wasn't something I ever had to work at. I think, you know, that's one of those things. It was just a gift from God, creative source, universe, whatever, because he knew I wanted to be a writer. So he knew that I needed to have some kind of like total just off switch when it comes to, you know, a lot of hesitancy to share those things. And I think what it... You know, there have been times when I felt like I shared a little too much or, I wasn't quite ready to share that. But I think what it comes down to is that I've always kind of intuitively known that we all experience the same things. Like, even if the specifics are slightly different, we are all basically having the same feelings, same emotions, same reactions. I've always been really drawn to comedy and music and literature that speaks very frankly about things that are, you know, things that we kind of all think but don't say. And I think I realized, oh yeah, we all are thinking the same things. We actually are all so similar. And so to reveal these intimate things, the details might seem really personal, but the actual experience is totally universal. We're all going through the same things. And if you didn't happen to go through grief for your estranged father, then you might have a friendship that's giving you the same complications, or you might have a romantic relationship with some of the specific, you know, some of the specificities of the emotion are similar. So that has never felt super, super vulnerable to me, which, you know, is a gift for what I happen to do.
Totally. Do you talk to anybody that's going to be mentioned in your book before it comes out? What is the checklist for before you publish this book? There are going to be like these stories that are written, especially with the relationships. Obviously, you're not using full names, but do they know they're about to be written and published and sometimes even drawn about?
I used to never ask anyone anything. I just kind of felt like, well, this is my story and I can say whatever and you hurt my feelings. And, you know, I think that was a pretty immature way to think about it. I kind of copied the Anne Lamott philosophy, which is if you didn't want someone to write about you, you should have behaved better. And I kind of used that as like a little, you know, mantra. And then I thought, that doesn't seem right. And I never want to write from a place of like revenge. You know, that's the last motivation for me.
You write about it from your perspective. From my interpretation of your writing, you don't really talk about other people. You talk about your feelings and the experience with other people, especially in Inner Sky, where you go through different paragraphs of forgiving different exes and different like past relationships. You still make it about you so that the person who is following this journey is experiencing like your feelings, your perspective. It's almost like the character, specifically in like these love relationships, they're not irrelevant. But it's just like, they're there. And that's why this experience has happened. So even when I read it, I don't feel like I'm really thinking about them and like, oh my gosh, I wonder how they feel or if they're okay with this, because it still is about you.
I'm so glad you brought up that distinction. I that's always been kind of my guiding, that's how I decide, you know, how I'm going to write about something. It has to be about me and not them. Mm-hmm. But I, for this book, I did ask, most people, how they felt about the story that I told about them.
What kind of people? We ought to get specific.
I know. I asked all of my friends. Okay. I didn't ask the men, but there were enough details I changed, and I don't like talk to them anymore. I don't even think they're gonna like know this book exists. It kind of felt okay to just like put that out there, and those stories were so, like you said, they were so about me, and the specifics of the person could easily be swapped out for others. It didn't matter that much. But when I was writing about a friend, especially a friend who had you know, been through something personal, like a fertility battle or something, you know, I wanted to make sure I was honoring that story correctly. There was one friend who I realized when I was recording the audiobook recently that I completely forgot to ask him how he felt about me sharing a story. And I just felt so bad about that, because I thought, I just totally forgot. I, you know, I was just unselfconsciously writing this story that, really, you know, affected me and changed my perspective on something. And then I thought, dang, I totally forgot to ask him. So I won't.
So did you end up talking to him about it?
I wrote him a letter and he was perfectly honored by it. But, you know, okay. I still felt like, oh, that wasn't mine to tell in that way. And, you know, next time I'll know. I'm always growing. I'm always learning this stuff. It's not like you write a book and that means that you've done it perfectly. It's like you're still learning lessons. There's still so many things I would have changed. But that's kind of the beauty of a book, too. It's like you can't change it. It's not an Instagram account. Like, it's going to exist as it is.
You write so beautifully about the stories and the experiences that I totally understand your friend being like, I am honored. Sometimes, as a reader, we forget that this is so personal. It's not fiction. You're going through the stories again. And it's hard because a lot of the stories are, you know, filled with trauma. How do you deal with the re-traumatizing parts of writing them? Or if there is still a level of trauma you haven't healed from it, do you choose to opt out of writing it? The particular story.
Yeah, I would, anything that feels unprocessed to me, it doesn't even feel worth writing about, because I know I'm not going to write about it in a way that's like meaningful. Or something that, you know, I think a lot of writers do is we kind of mythologize our life. So we, you know, these things happen to us and we think about, what does that mean in the greater story of my life? Or what are the symbols there?
Right.
Or what does this mean, you know, in the context of kind of where my narrative was going? When you see your life that way, you need a lot of time to process, and you need these processing tools for raw, unprocessed, you know, grief and pain especially. It's not really that interesting to read about, because there's, you know, what's interesting is making meaning from those really difficult times. But I will say there were a couple things I knew were going to be hard to write about, because they're really painful. I mean, one was this like heartbreak after 2 weeks of dating someone. And I remember like having to listen to music that reminded me of that time and really getting into that place, looking at old texts and kind of like putting myself back there as much as I could. And it was really sad. I was writing in this bakery window and I was just, you know, I was crying and I thought, this is exactly how I should be writing this. You know, I want to be totally back there so that I can speak from these very real emotions. But as someone who finds a lot of value in times of melancholy and sadness, there's something kind of pleasurable about that. It's almost like, ooh, like how much can I feel this? like, ooh, this is,
well, kind you're of... not afraid of your feelings.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think this is all really refreshing and incredible guidance, because oftentimes when people realize they have a story to share, they have a story they want to share or that they can tell, it is still unprocessed, but they feel like that's when you should share it and you have to feel that, and that's why it's worth sharing. I don't think we talk enough about processing your trauma and healing before sharing things. And I have to learn that myself when I was working on a documentary around the sex trade and all of these, you know, feelings and emotions were dredging up for me. It was the first time I had gone to therapy. And while I don't regret any part of that journey and experience, I realized even though I thought I was healed from certain things, there were things that I didn't realize I was healed from. And it gave me the biggest lesson ever, which was you aren't ready to investigate or share these stories or write about this until you've done that work. Because just like you said, the value in the story that you are sharing comes from that reflective place where you're just like, oh, I see what this meant in this time of life, or I see what this actually was. And it's not like you're projecting an emotion onto it that doesn't make what you're saying clear.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
What an adventure that is. Another adventure is your very fun, colorful love life. And to me, you are like the real life Carrie Bradshaw, except with way more adventure. You write about way more things. You help us heal a lot more. You do a lot more self work. But I mean, you are the real life Starry Mari. And coming up with the question about relationships for me was the hardest one to come up with for you, because you just share so much and it's really fun to follow. So I'll keep it broad because I want to see where you take this. But the question is, what is your relationship with relationships?
That's a great question. That's a great question. It's really funny. So we've talked about this before. I always just wanted to get married. I never wanted to date. I didn't see the point. I thought all I want to do is get married. And so for various reasons, one of which I was an only child who just grew up with my mom, and I wanted like a family. I wanted to belong somewhere. I wanted to make this micro community. That's something that's always been really important to me. So for my early 20s, I didn't date. I had a boyfriend who was a really good friend, and I thought we're going to get married. And then I thought, oh, well, you know, this isn't quite working the way I wanted. And so I guess I'll marry someone else. And then when I was about 25, I realized, oh, I've never dated before. What would that be like? And so I made myself go on dates, and I had no interest in doing it. I felt really inexperienced. I didn't know, you know, I didn't know the rules or anything. I'm like a lot of my friends, you know, I'm willing to get really deep in conversation very quickly with someone. And that's not something that works that well with
dating. I don't understand how people aren't like that. I'm just like, don't you want to share your secrets?
Just go for it. I know. Like, hi, I'm Mari. Here are all of my traumas and my deepest fears and wishes and thoughts about religion and politics and all this stuff that Same. You shouldn't open with. But I love that stuff. So I realized, you know, as I was exploring this part of myself I'd never explored before, I had a lot of fun. And I also was on the pursuit of a long-term relationship, and finding myself disappointed a lot and single a lot, and had to kind of reconcile with those feelings. I once found like a Reddit thread about myself that was not nice.
And no way.
I know. It was so yucky. I was like looking for something else and I accidentally found this. And one thing that the people said, I didn't read, I only read like, you know, the first part of it. But one thing that they said is she's like obsessed with relationships, but wants us to know that she's fine being single. And it's funny because I thought, you're right. Like I like dating. I'm fascinated by people. That's why I'm a hospital chaplain now. I love people's stories. I love hearing I'm so curious about individuals. That's one reason, again, I, you know, love traveling, and especially love traveling alone because I can meet people so easily. So dating for me is really fun and enriching, and it's like having a deep conversation with someone You know, every other night. It's interesting. And then there is this ambivalence of feeling like, wait, I don't like being rejected. I don't like the fact that I put myself out there so much and I'm still coming home and I'm alone. There are some really beautiful things about being alone. What are those? And yet I still have, you know, this this longing and to share myself and deeply connect. And so I don't like that we tend to put people in these buckets of like, oh, you know, she's thinks she's this empowered single woman, but she's like obsessed with dating. And, you know, that's true. I love solitude and I love the many things that a beautiful single life can give. And I love being in a relationship and I also like dating. So I am all over the place. But what I love about my relationship with relationships is I do really like people at the end of the day. And it's a good way to meet people.
I just hope that we get all of these amazing stories because I think this is an amazing dynamic. It's not the cliche like finding people to date people just to date people. There's like intention behind it. And also you talk a lot about enjoying solitude and enjoying being alone. And honestly, I personally have learned about that from you. And I've learned about like solo travel from you and the adventures from you. To me, it's really inspiring. I think it's really amazing. And I hope that we get to see all of these amazing stories in a hopefully upcoming adaptation of your first memoir, Am I There Yet? Which, hello. Now that you know that potentially your entire life or part of your life is going to be a television show, do you know how you would direct your life as a TV show and what it would look like?
Ooh. I have no idea. People were asking me 3 years ago, we started this TV project and we just kind of got it together. And I have like no way of seeing myself from the outside. I don't think anyone does. You know, it's like you know all of your complexities, you know all of your flaws, you know all of the things that are going on inside, and you can't really tell what it looks like from the outside. But I will say one thing that I kept bringing up in these TV meetings, and I don't actually have a whole lot to say, but one thing I really wanted is color. I wanted a really colorful version of wherever it was. So I think they've decided to set it in New York after much debate about setting it in D.C. or Chicago. I would love a show in D.C. because I think D.C. is so beautiful. That's where we both lived for years, and I'm so grateful for it.
Oh, my gosh. I feel like we do need a D.C. show that is not about politics.
I know. And I'm so in love with the aesthetics of D.C. I think it's a beautiful city. It's really diverse. It's really interesting. It's got this incredible...
It's my favorite city in the country.
Really? It's yeah, amazing.
Totally.
It's
I mean, amazing. Once you live in DC, because I think part of the reason it's my favorite city, it's also my husband Adam's favorite city to live in. And if he could live anywhere other than in New York, that's where he would live. Because one, we just had such a great time, but DC is like a secret. It's like people don't, like when you talk about DC to them, They think Capitol, White House.
Sure.
And they think whoever is in those. I'm like, those people don't even live in D.C. Like, they're not even. But the culture and the art and the history in D.C. is just phenomenal. We lived on 13th and U Street. So there was like go-go music playing outside all the time. Yes. We were right next to literally less than a block away from Ben's Chili Bowl and the Lincoln Theater. And it was just fantastic. And this is my pitch to if anybody at Amazon is listening. I think a DC show is made. Somebody should do that's just such a great idea.
I know. And just the row houses, like, you know, like I said, what I wanted colorful. Was color. They're colorful. And I also felt like something I really wanted was really fun music, international music. Like, let's bring to light some of these artists who aren't as big in the US, but super big in their home countries and music I listen to. And I feel like, you know, DC is a really international city, which is something I love about it. And you hear all kinds of music. I got so into Brazilian music when I was there. And I feel like if I have, you know, one guiding value, it's joie de vivre. It's like getting as much out of life as I can. And of course, if there's a show about me, I want it to reflect that. So just as much color, music, smells, sights, you know, as possible.
You have found a way to be incredibly honest in your writing, but make it accessible because it's colorful, because the writing is so beautiful and fun and like curly, and there's little illustrations everywhere. And it just makes me feel like I can read this. Like I can read this and it's not going to scare me away. And I think that's a really hard thing to do. It allows for people to actually feel their feelings all the way through, because they can enjoy this color and joy and beauty and then reach out to you through your writing. One of my favorite lines from Inner Sky, and it's also one of the illustrations, but I'll read the line. It is, "To live life to the fullest means to feel life to the fullest. Full pain, full boredom, full unfairness, full magnificence, full mourning, full lazy days, full of joy, full disappointment, and full creativity." All of these feelings manifest in your writing so deeply. Were you always good at feeling your feelings all the way through?
No. Nope. No, I was not, because society doesn't teach us that. I've been learning a lot about embodiment in the past year. It's like my new obsession, and embodiment is not splintering any part of your body off because it doesn't belong. And our thoughts and our emotions are in our body. So saying like, this thought doesn't belong, this emotion doesn't belong, that's disembodiment. It actually, I mean, what trauma is being disembodied. You know, like if someone were to curse you out or whatever, you actually kind of leave your body because it doesn't feel safe to be in there. And we are like, in very small ways, constantly traumatized by society who tell us to splinter off certain things from our body, to, you know, not be fully in our desires. I mean, our society has a lot of issues with sexual desire, and, you know, we're just now getting to a point where we're, you know, welcoming the entire gender spectrum and all of that. But for so many years, that's one example, but there's so many ways that our society says your part of your body doesn't belong. Maybe, you know, a desire for something doesn't belong, or a thought doesn't belong, or a feeling doesn't belong. And in our especially North American contemporary culture, women tend to experience this for the first time in a really profound way when they're about 11 or 12, and men experience it at 5. Because men are so often told that their feelings don't matter, you know, or their feelings aren't, like, so many of their feelings don't belong. If it's not angry or, like, pride, you know, it doesn't belong in their body. And I definitely experienced that, especially high school in my early 20s, feeling like I wanted to be a really smart person. And to me, that meant not being fun. It meant not having any like sexual or romantic desire. It meant not wanting to dress in a certain way, or, you know, it was like I kept so much from myself because I felt like to be a smart woman in society meant certain things. And it wasn't until I kind of started, you know, releasing so many of those stories and saying, I'm going to do what I want to do. And sometimes that will look like dressing up in a business suit, you know, but it's that freedom to make that decision, and not something that I'm feeling like is coming from that society has chosen for me. So I think I'm still, that's such an ongoing process. So still letting these emotions in, and still letting these things guide me that I feel like I shouldn't for whatever reason.
Do you actually remember anything, like even one example in your life that you internalized and said, okay, this is what a smart woman should do and be like?
I mean, where would I begin? I was really influenced. I've always been really interested in religion and spirituality, and I actually have really warm thoughts toward toward religion. But I think I got caught up pretty young in what I thought a good Christian woman looked, thought, felt, and acted like.
Were you raised Christian?
Yeah, it's a little complicated because my parents, my dad was atheist. I wouldn't say that my mom was super religious, but she brought me to church. So I think I saw something in church that I loved, which was making meaning of life and having this very deep experience of life. And church was the only place where I felt like I could wrestle with these big life questions and ask these questions that I wanted to ask people. But, you know, like 5-year-olds don't really want to talk about like the meaning of suffering. There was something in church that I was very drawn to. It was also philosophical, you know, even in Sunday school was like we were talking about these kind of big topics that I was like, ooh, I like this. By the time I was a teenager, we were starting to talk about purity, which is, you know, still something in a lot of ways that I think is really harmful. Just the idea of purity, you know, I think is not really great for us. So I thought about, well, you know, a good Christian girl doesn't speak up and doesn't get angry and doesn't like Britney Spears and doesn't like silly stuff and it doesn't, you know, isn't shallow. Like that was a really big thing for me, is like not being seen as shallow. When that's okay. Like I can be deep and love nail polish. Like that's so real. And I told myself that wasn't allowed. So I spent a lot of time as a teenager, especially just feeling like totally splintered off from a very real part of myself, which was kind of the fun loving person.
What would you tell your teenage self now about that?
I keep a photo of her in my room and try to really interact with her. It's actually a little painful for me to think about my teenage self. I have no problem thinking about my childhood self, but my teenage self, God, I read these journals and, you know, there's just so much longing there and so much like feeling like there was something so deeply wrong with me. And I think I would just say, God, you are so perfect. Like you are so amazing. And I would love to know her. She was really different from me now. And just say like, oh my gosh, like you are so, I'm so in love with you. Like you have so much to offer. You're so cool. I love that you don't care what people think about you. I love that you wear these crazy clothes and love that you had a pixie cut in high school. Like that's cool. I love that you loved your mom so much. You know, there's all these beautiful things that I just wasn't able to recognize at the time because I was too busy trying to fit into an idea of myself that I had.
Wow. I would have loved to be friends with her, too. I think my teenage self would have loved to be friends with her. Hi there. If you find our work beneficial and you want to support how we build our company at your service, you can subscribe to my Patreon at patreon.com/nor. It's usually personal writings, and as I build a community on there, hopefully more. Your support is how we build. I also curate a weekly newsletter of all the things I'm benefiting from and enjoying that week. Anything from what I'm reading, watching, listening, buying, and more. Like most things, I keep it personal. You can subscribe to it at nortagori.com/newsletter. Now back to the story.
Your dad, Sam Andrew, was actually an artist too, and he was in the band Big Brother and the Holding Company, and even helped launch Janis Joplin's career. And you have been so gracious to share so many stories about your estranged relationship with him and about dealing with the grief of his passing in 2015. And honestly, I think you sharing those stories is one of those big moments where you give people language and imagery to move through their own grief.
regardless of what it is, because everybody has different experiences. But as an artist who is the daughter of an artist, what struggles do you think you and your dad both shared, and how did you choose to approach them?
Ooh, that's a good question. That's been my life journey. That's been like my adulthood journey. And it's such an ongoing process, but I think we share a lot of traits that a lot of artists do, which are not very easy traits to live with. He had so many incredible qualities of really seeking like the marrow out of life. I read some of his writings. He's a musician, but he was also a great writer. And I was reading the way that he described the weather in San Francisco, and it was so funny because I was like, did I write this? Like, he noticed the same things that I do. He had that same kind of artist's, pair of glasses that really gave him this amazing attention to detail. And he also was very curious about people, really interested in people's lives. I loved going around the city with him, and he would talk to like parking attendants and people who other people didn't usually talk to. You know, he would like ask people their stories and ask like, what's your life like? He had no hesitancy about that. He'd say like, what's your religion? And what do they, just this endless curiosity, and people just loved him. So he had that, but he also had, these things that are really hard to live with, which is like, a kind of a self, there's a bit of self-absorption that I understand. I have it too. Like, you kind of have to in order to write about yourself and like really dig up these emotions. You have to think about yourself a lot. And that makes you want to be the victim a lot. It makes you really self-centered. It makes you think about your experiences above other people's. And that is something that I actively work against every day. You know, I can see myself slipping into that sometimes. And it's something that, I'm grateful for the example of that not going well, and for him really not being able to deal with a lot of these big emotions. He was someone like me who was extremely sensitive, and he grew up in a very, very strict household where I'm sure that was not okay. You know, I'm sure he grew up in Texas and in this very strict Catholic family. And I'm sure a lot of his sensitivities or his more artistic tendencies were not allowed. And I'm sure that was extremely painful. But I think the gift of healing through that is realizing, how can I integrate my own painful experiences so that I don't take them out on other people? Or how can I be more compassionate to myself so I can be more compassionate to other people? And that sounds so like, like something you'd read at a yoga studio, but it's so hard. It's so hard to say, I am an artistic person, and I know I am compassionate and generous, but I'm also jealous. I'm also resentful. I'm also like irritable, and all of that matters. All of it belongs in me. And that's going to make me a lot more compassionate to other people. I'm going to see them as these whole, beautiful human beings with so many shadows and light going on. And to learn that, all of that belongs, but there are ways to manage that, and there are ways to even turn that into art in a really beautiful way, as opposed to shutting people out.
I mean, that's what you did. You turned this struggle and this fear and feeling of abandonment into art that has made so many other people feel less alone. I mean, I wonder what he would have had to say if he had read your books. And like, if he would have felt seen, and if he would have felt that was familiar. How do you balance knowing that your stories and the extent and massiveness of your gift is also a result of so much pain? And how do you parallel that with the journey of trying to forgive somebody who hurt you?
Yeah, it's a funny one, isn't it? Because it's like, wow, this pain is really, you know, the source for a lot of my creativity and the way of my, the way that I found meaning in the world and connection with people and like this very lush empathy when I really tap into it. But would I have asked for it to happen? No. So it's a kind of interesting dance of like, well, I have to heal this on my own because it does actually cause me pain. It's not just creative inspiration. It actually does affect my life. And this resolve I have to use every scrap of my life for good. I kind of, it's like artistic composting. It's like, all right, I didn't want this wow. banana peel or these eggshells, but I'm going to use them to make like rich soil.
Is that a phrase that is used, artistic composting?
I thought I made it up. I'll have to look it up to see if other people have said it, because it seems like such an easy metaphor, right? But it just like came to me one day, and I thought someone surely has thought about this. Like, how to,
wow,
you know,
I really love that. Is part of the resentment like, what if I didn't become this artist? What if I didn't become this writer? Like, I had to do this on my own.
Yeah, I mean, that's so real. Like, what if I didn't have the tools? What if I couldn't make meaning out of it? That would be really hard. I mean, I think that's kind of what happened to my dad. I think he had a lot of pain that he didn't channel in a way that was for the good of others. And I think creativity, you know, by its like ancient definition, is an act of service. It's you know, it's something that is for other people. So even if you're not going to share your journal entries or poems about, you know, the pain that you've been through, those are still healing because you're healing yourself for the good of your community and for your friends and family and all of that. So even in those private creative moments, creativity is still in service to others. So I think that in order to make art and write and all of that, you have to be thinking about other people. You have to be thinking about how will this heal other people? How will this affect other people? I think that is a really important thing to keep in mind when you're creating.
Did you ever listen to his music and like try to analyze the lyrics and see if that's what he was doing?
Ooh, no, I haven't. His last record, I know, has a song about me, and I still haven't been able to listen to it. It's like too.
Whoa.
But I think he wrote it when I was little, so it's a little less intense. It's like a lullaby. And
you've never listened to it before?
No, I can kind of like I he used to sing it to me. I can kind of hear it in my head, but I haven't listened to the recording. And yeah, I wonder a lot, like, he obviously channeled so much of himself into his music. I mean, he was so like naturally expressive. And I do wonder if that was at all healing for him or if he did it for his ego, which is real, you know, and I wouldn't judge him for that because I think that's probably why most people, like, if you ask, like, a lot of teenagers these days, like, why do you want a big TikTok audience? Why do you want to make videos for YouTube? It's to be famous. And what I would like to ask about that, you know, in follow up is like, what would it feel like to be famous? How would that make your life better? You know, like, what are the exact things so that you can like buy things? Well, once you buy the things, what's that experience going to be like? You know, how are you going to feel when you get those things that you buy? And I'd like people to be a little more self-aware. But I think a lot of people say, I just want to be a rock star. I just want to be like famous and cool and get the girls or, you know, whatever. But because my dad was so introspective, I do wonder about the healing process. And, you know, it's one of those things that I would love to know and I'll never know. So I have to have these little imaginary conversations with him so that I can find out.
You are on your own healing journey and you've gone on your own healing journey, even with a relationship coach who specializes in attachment and abandonment wounds. And in your book, you refer to him as Basement Bob.
Yep.
Can you share with us some of your biggest takeaways from your healing journey?
I think what I found from these amazing, powerful, beautiful, successful women who I am friends with, who are single and on the hunt for a good relationship, is that our culture often frames getting a relationship as sort of getting a prize once you've worked on yourself. Like, you do all this work on yourself, and then you get the lollipop, you get the boyfriend, and that, you know, cures all of your loneliness and insecurities, and you're happy for the rest of your life. And there are obviously a lot of issues with that narrative, and I'm trying to pull that apart a little bit in what I write about and what I make art about. I think that healing, I see so many relationship coaches or life coaches on Instagram who kind of frame the healing as a way to get what you want. Like, once you heal yourself, then you'll get the job you want. Then you'll, you know, you'll wake up with shiny skin. Then you'll get this relationship. And healing has to be an end in and of itself. You know, you can't heal to get something, because that's not the point. The point is to be as whole as possible. The root word of healing comes from wholeness. So to be, you know, a whole person who, I mean, I don't like to speak in terms of people are broken, but there are little parts of you that might be wounded or a little splintered off, like we talked about, you know, that you're denying yourself. And once you heal, you start integrating all of those parts and you say, I do carry this wound, but you know what? It makes some beautiful art, or it helps me empathize with others, or I carry this and it helps me really deeply connect, as opposed to I carry this and it affects everything that I do in a really negative way and it makes me lash out on people. So healing has to be for yourself and not to get a prize, because that's when you start doing it in all of these weird ways that really are kind of counterproductive.
That just seems like a tiny but massive missing piece in the puzzle, because that answer is only an answer that you can get from starting the healing journey and knowing that this is a massive reward in itself. We take away an aspect of worthiness when we say, once you do this, you can get this. Like, once you do this, you are worthy of this job. You are worthy of this relationship. And also, I mean, as humans, we're really good with like lists and checking things off and wanting to cross things off our to-do list and setting up immaculate plans. But we are not good planners. In my faith, I'm Muslim. We have a saying that God is the best of all planners, because literally in life, like, you can plan everything to a T, but that's not how it's going to work. It never works that way. I'm trying to process what you just said, because I think I realize now a lot of the times I see that language around healing. Maybe it is a social media thing. Maybe it is a thing that we see online because people want things to digest and feel like they can do. And then, like, it's still very shallow. I mean, we talk about social media being shallow all the time. And it, like you've said, doesn't allow for us to evolve.
Yeah.
And people like find you and follow you for this one version of yourself, but maybe not for the next one. And that can change every day, or that can change every year. How has this realization shifted your relationship that you have with your presence online? Because that is how things got started with your first book.
Yeah. So, the way that I used to write and draw really no longer applies. I still love that person, and I have a lot of love for that art, but a lot of that was from a really unhealed place. A lot of the things that I used to write about, I wouldn't see that way anymore. And I've been doing this now for 6 years. Like, I'm going to grow and I'm going to evolve, and I think there was a sort of I mean, I've always been super optimistic, but I think there was a bit more of a kind of like sarcastic or cynical edge that I had that I think was really, that was where I was in life. You know, I had
it not... also does really good on social media. Like having a cynical exactly. edge does so good. That's what gets celebrated.
That is what's celebrated. People love to feel like, you know, like vindicated for their resentment. And I used to write about like how much I judged my ex-boyfriend's new girlfriend and, you know, like how I would like judge a guy throughout a whole date and like, you know, judging him for everything he did. And I wouldn't see it that way at all now, at all. And I've also like healed so much with the way I see men. And I really hate the way that men are so often portrayed in this kind of art as like just kind of these like objects who can't do anything right. I mean, there's all kinds of issues going on. And I, again, like I have love for that artist, you know, she is me. And obviously that's a part of me. But since I started really healing a lot of those wounds, I'm just not going to write that stuff anymore. It doesn't come naturally to me. It would actually be a huge effort to try to get back there. And I'm also interested in different things. I've always been really interested in spiritual writing and theology and philosophy, and all of my favorite writers have some kind of spiritual or religious bend. I actually, I think what got me like really, really interested in spirituality and religion was the mystic, the Sufi poets when I was in my early 20s. And I realized, oh, this exists. Like, wow, you can believe in God and like it can and you can like also appreciate, you know, the sensual experience of life so much. And it's the same thing. Whoa. And then I learned about the Christian mystics, who are also amazing. And I've incorporated a lot of that philosophy into my writing. That is really different from making cartoons about how a guy didn't pay for your dinner, you know, but it's from the same person. And one thing that's been really encouraging to me is seeing, like studying older writers and artists and looking at their career and how much they've evolved and how much they've experimented and how much their own, you know, personal, whatever they're going through really affected the twists and turns of their careers in a really beautiful way. That's really exciting to me, but I think social media does limit that a bit because it's all about, you know, this platform you've built. And once you're on that platform, you got to kind of keep riding it. And I have no interest in doing that. I have no interest in consistency. I don't think that's not like a value of mine. And I really value authenticity, which is going to look very different every day. So I do wonder if these platforms actually kind of put us in a little box, or if there is opportunity to really grow and take the people you want with you. I think the problem is it's so focused on numbers. And I know the more authentic I get, the more I'm going to lose followers. And that's going to upset, you know, some people who like, you know, publish my books or whatever. But it doesn't upset me. I'm happy to have whoever wants to be there.
It's interesting that you mentioned the words authenticity and consistency, because a mentor of mine, Seth Godin, I learned this from him. He says that there is no such thing as authenticity and there's only such thing as consistency, because, and I took it a step further, and I think that we can only truly be authentic to ourselves, because no matter what it, whether it's on social media or at your job, in a family setting, whatever it is, you're always performing something. And that's not a bad thing. I think it's just setting boundaries. It's like, I have boundaries for this, and this is how I show up here. I have boundaries for this, and this is how I show up here. So for consistency, and this is like as a fan, Noor, talking to Mari. For consistency, I think you writing as raw and open and authentic as you do is the promise that you make. Consistency is just like keeping your promise, and your promise is, I'm going to share my truths, and those truths evolve because I'm a human who is evolving and people enjoy watching that. So I know if I saw like new writing, I mean, like the writing that you have right now, but even if you were to enter the more spiritual side, which I know is such a big part of you, I would love it. And also, in fact, I think whenever you're serving an algorithm, you're going to lose followers and numbers and whatever. Like, it's just not like set up for people who want to stay human. But you do gain new audiences who are looking for that. And sometimes I think about this. I think about this with myself too, because I've been on social media for over 10 years as someone who had like a following. And there are always going to be people who kind of stick around for the evolution, like that core group of people. The community building aspect of it only seems like fun to me when it's people who are like also evolving too. And that's like a really cool thing, is I do believe that the internet in general and social media can stifle aspects of our evolution or healing or growing, but it also gives us a bunch of language and tools. Like my Instagram and my TikTok, the entire feed is all therapy. It's all therapy stuff. And I'm just like, yeah, this is what I love. And I forget that that's not everybody else's feeds.
Right.
That just goes to show you that there are people who are also evolving along the way too. And I totally get in the same train of thought, but then the way that I kind of take like step back from it is I'm just going to think better of other people. I know that these platforms don't serve the best things, but I'm going to choose people, and I'm going to choose to think highly of people and know that there are other people out there who are trying to go on the same journeys as me. And sometimes when I pose certain questions online and I get the responses, it's so. Like, for instance, a couple of weeks ago, I had a panic attack, and it was after I had drank in a lot of coffee, and that has never happened before. And so I posted about it, and I asked people for recommendations, and there were like, it was like the equivalent of pages that people wrote about their experiences and how they, and what they do now and what that's done for them. And I was just like, oh, cool. We're like on the same, I don't know you personally, but we're on the same, and I can come to you for advice. And it's just so refreshing. It's hard to maintain and it's hard to like remember that, but it happens.
Yeah, that's so true. That's so true. People, yeah, it's not like people remain static while I evolve. Like, people are also on their journeys, and it's a beautiful thing. I mean, I've, a lot of my favorite artists and writers started pretty young, and to think that their audience has grown up with them, you know, that's something really beautiful.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the storytelling session. I just wanted to share something with you. If you're looking for a good deed opportunity these days, my family has been working to alleviate local homelessness for over 10 years. We have a foundation called I See You, and we make care packages for people experiencing homelessness. We make family food bags with food staples and give out grocery gift cards to families in need and more. Everything is done by donation, and 100% of the money goes towards community members in need. If you'd like to donate, you can through Venmo at ISY Foundation or PayPal to contact@isyfoundation.org. If you or someone you know is in need in the DC, Maryland, and Virginia area and could use our help, please DM on Instagram ISY Foundation or shoot us an email. Now back to our story. Social media is a new thing. There was a time where authors did not have that platform. What would you tell publishers who now are looking at social media numbers first before the person? And what does that do for like the craft of writing?
Oh gosh, yeah, I think that can be so damaging. I get so many questions about how do I build a platform so that I can write a book, you know, and it's like, oh gosh, I wish you could just write a book. Like,
totally.
You know, pretend it's like the 19th century and we don't have this. Or 20 years ago, for example. People figured it out. Even like, I think about like, how did I remember reading Eat, Pray, Love as a teenager. It was like a huge, huge book. And I was thinking, how did I learn about it? Like, I must have learned about it from a magazine.
I think book clubs were really big too.
Book clubs.
Yeah, it was magazines, book club. I mean, I was actually just listening to an interview yesterday. I forgot who the author was, but I've been listening to a lot of author interviews. And she said that when she was in Oprah's book club, her books would, it was like a guaranteed at least million copies sold. Wow. And she was like, I don't think that that's like the same as it is now. Right. But, and I was just like, imagine. I remember the Oprah book club being like an international phenomenon.
Yes.
I don't know what you could get on now that would guarantee you a million copies sold, but it happened before social media.
Right. And not that long ago. And social media will also not exist at some point. And, you know, in its format, I think Instagram has changed so much even in the past few years. And, you know, even releasing a book 3 years ago, the way that Instagram is now, you know, that, yeah, the algorithm's a complete disaster. And there are things, I think the publishing industry is so old school and they see, oh, well, every time you post, you're going to get this number of sales or whatever. And that's not the way it works. I'd also want to tell them that is so out of your control. You can pick someone, you can like sign someone who has 15 million followers. They may never post about the book. That is well within their rights, you know, and they can like,
wow. Right?
Yeah. It's funny to me that people like in the publishing world will like, assume that I'll do certain things that I'm like, I don't ever do that. I mean, back when I released my first book, I never did stories and I refused to do a swipe up. I just didn't want to. And I'm sure they were like banking on that, but I was like, no, I'm not going to do that. And there are, you know, they think like, oh, if these two influencers like collaborate on something, it'll, and it's like, you don't know what people are going to want. And so to look at numbers is so damaging, and it's also not it doesn't necessarily work, so,
and it doesn't feel good.
It doesn't feel good. I don't like to be you know, prioritized by the industry because of a number. I want them to read what I have to say and say, oh, this resonates or it doesn't. And
yeah
it doesn't feel good to be like at all associated with a number that is so in flux. I mean, I could lose all of my followers tomorrow. Like, what, you know, it's like, that's so out of my control and out of their control and doesn't really matter.
So. Yeah, totally. Is there a book inside of you that you really want to write, but you're just unsure of if you're going to, you know, that almost constipation feeling that you have before you like get it out?
Yeah. Well, this book, My Inner Sky, that I just published, was originally going to be this like spiritual memoir, kind of in the style of a lot of these spiritual memoirs that I really love. And the publisher was like, this is like a little too different from what you're doing. You kind of have to evolve into that, which in hindsight, I understand. At the time, I thought, I want to do what I want. But I do understand like gently guiding your audience somewhere that you want to go. I would say at this point, I feel like I need to gather some more experiences. I need to get some more messages from the universe. I feel like I did put so much of my soul into My Inner Sky, and that's something that I'm really proud of. And now I'm working on like getting more messages, which is why I started work at the hospital and why I want to put myself in the path of, you know, more life, big life things so that I have something to write about.
I mean, I so look forward to that book. I mean, Inner Sky feels spiritual to me, but I'm a spiritual person, so I kind of project that anywhere anyway. Yeah, totally. But what is so magical about it is it's about the in-between moments, which, by the way, you wrote this book before COVID and somehow knew that we would need this right now. And on the first page, you write, we are good at starting and we are good at finishing, but we don't know what to do with ourselves in the in-between. Our culture is just not set up to support it. I felt that so deeply. Why did you feel the need to write this book?
I think this was a book that just so largely wrote itself once I had the idea for it. Once I got that idea of the in-between, I couldn't stop. I did a TED Talk in Greece that was actually never recorded, so it'll never come out. But it was about transitions, and I was working with a coach to help me write the speech, and she was this amazing Greek woman who didn't even speak a ton of English, but you know, like when people who have limited vocabulary just say things in the most poetic, beautiful way.
Yes.
It's like, oh my gosh, I would have never thought to phrase it that way. But she brought up this image of the lobsters growing into their new shell, which is something that I wrote about. And she explained this because she knew what I was trying to say, and she wanted me to have more illustrations to say it. So she told me about how lobsters, when they're growing into their new shell, which happens periodically, they'll get really, really uncomfortable, and that's their cue to burrow by themselves alone. And she said the gift of that example is that we do have the right to be totally alone in our experience, and that's okay. It sounds like it's something that shouldn't be okay, but it is okay. And so there's this kind of balance that I was trying to write about, which is it's okay to be totally alone in your experience. That's something that everyone goes through. And also there is this big community. You know, lobsters are all doing that at the same time alone. You know, it's like they're all going into their own individual burrows to become new lobsters. And that's something that they do in solitude, and it's something that, you know, if they have a rich emotional life, which I don't know if they do or not, but that's something that, you know, would feel very lonely. But it's also something that is like they are evolved to do, they are created to do.
Right.
It's something that all of them do. So there's this kind of like, you know, claiming your own solitude and also being part of a community. And those stories just kind of flew out of my hands.
Tell me about present thinking over positive thinking.
Yeah, positive thinking. I started realizing when everyone is telling me to do it, it was splintering off these emotions. You know, like I've been saying, there's this kind of denying these very real emotions by smashing them with positivity. It's almost like this like boot that I'm stomping on my very real present emotions that are trying to get my attention. They're like these little feelings tugging at my dress saying, look at me, pay attention to me. That's what a feeling is. It's saying this matters to you, like pay attention. And to squash them with this positive thinking really brings us out of the present moment. Positive thinking brings us into a future that we don't know about yet, whereas the present we do know about. And to be really attentive to what's going on right in front of us, to say, you are the most important person in the world because you're right in front of me. Feeling you are the most important thing I could be feeling because you're right in front of me, as opposed to, you know, squashing it with this hazy, like positive future that we don't have any control over. I think that's really damaging to our emotional experience.
I think that's so beautiful. I'm so grateful for that lesson. I've told you so many times, I felt that so deeply. And I also loved that you divided the book into parts of the day. So things like golden hour, twilight, night, and dawn. How did you choose to divide years and years of stories into one day?
I felt like the, you know, this message to only think positive kind of felt like people saying, only focus on the afternoon. The afternoon is the only time of day that matters. And, you know, don't pay attention to the night. Pretend the morning doesn't exist. The afternoon is where it's at. And you might think like, oh, yeah, okay, that's like a sunny time of day. That's lovely. But I like dinner. And I actually really find night to be this really sacred time. And so I was thinking about, wait, these other experiences of my life are important too. Like, I want to bring it all. If we can say that every time of day matters, why can't we say that every time of life matters? So that was my guiding metaphor. And what I really wanted to do is get away from this thinking that like only bad things happen at night, because you know that's not true. Like some of the best things happen at night. And I wanted to, like those, I did write about like some really hard experiences, but there were also like, you know, the most beautiful and informative experiences too. So it's so easy to just say like, day is happy and joyful and night is so dark and sad, but darkness is beautiful. That's kind of
where, I've always been more drawn to darkness. Yeah. I've always loved that. I mean, I love, my favorite part of the day is the morning, but when it's still dark. I find so much creativity and I find so much clarity in that time. I think that's incredible. What has been the hardest in-between time for you? And what do you tell yourself when it gets extra hard?
I think this year has been the hardest in-between time, because the problem, or I think the hard thing about in-between times is you don't know what the parameters are. You don't know what the beginning is and what the end is. Like, can we say the day the pandemic began? No, it could be, you could pick the first day that I had to stay inside, the first day that restaurants closed, the first day that I was really sad, the first day someone died, you know, the first day I knew someone who died. Like, there's so many different ways we could begin it. And then what will be the end? It's not going to be one day. It's not going to be like one day everything's open and we're going to 12 parties.
I know.
It's going to be really gradual. And I found that when I was like recovering from this physical illness, where I kept fantasizing about like, the first day I can walk is going to be so amazing. But it took 6 months to walk. So there wasn't like one moment. So this past year has been really hard, because it's like we're longing for something that we don't even know what it looks like. And that's tough. That's tough. And I think like creatively, I just have been in such a slump, because normally I write about my personal experiences, and that's something that I can bring to the table. It's something I can kind of bring to light to other people. But we're all going through the same thing, so I kind of feel like I don't really have anything to add. Like, I can talk about my experience, but it's not really that compelling, because it's not, you know, unique to what anyone else is going through, and in most ways is much easier. So it's been a hard time to not feel like myself. I think that is kind of a mark of the in-between time, is like not really feeling like yourself.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, because if you're not feeling yourself, you're still going through that experience as an individual. And maybe that just means that this part is unprocessed. And once you've processed it, you'll know what you're going to write about it. Listen, I'm just using your words. I'm just telling you what you taught me.
It sounds so much better coming from you. Oh my goodness.
We're just so used to like the things that we say, that it loses that whatever. So I hope that made you feel good, because I know it makes me feel good when that happens. Is there anything that you can teach us about your creative process that you think would be useful for anybody?
You know, I always feel self-conscious talking about my creative process, because it actually is really spiritual. I feel like ideas come to me and then I write them. And my best ideas, like my best writing, I know that something is good when I don't feel like I did it. And I don't, you know, that's not like false humility. It actually feels that way. It actually feels like someone else.
It's divine.
It's divine. And that's when I read something, I'm like, oh, that's good. But I don't even remember writing it. It really felt like a co-production. And so I don't know how I would teach others to do that, but I will say this. I have really good people in my life. You're one of them. I know you have really good people in your life. And I think that comes from knowing yourself really well. It comes from a sort of confidence where you can seek out these remarkable people in your life and kind of offer yourself to them as a friend and community member. And I will say that talking to my friends is the best creative process. Like, I learn what I think when I talk to people.
Yep.
Like, sometimes I'm not even aware that I have a thought until I'm like literally just texting. I mean, this isn't like
when it comes out. Yeah.
But it's like, wow, this person brings out this part of me that I really like. And when I talk to him, I feel like I'm having these revelations, and that makes it into my work. So I think one of, you know, a underrated creative process is chatting, talking to people.
I love that. I definitely relate to that. I talk so much. That's literally what I do for a living. And I'm, as watching these home videos, I'm realizing, I just saw videos of me at 5 years old directing my parents and telling them what questions to ask me.
Yes.
Like I'm telling them how to interview me.
Yes. I love that for you.
It was,
you would have been the most amazing child.
It was pretty fabulous. I was very, very excited about it. I think that when you talk, not just for the sake of talking, which I, even though I talk a lot, I am very conscious of like engaging in conversation that's intentional. And if I'm sharing something, I'm sharing it with intention and not just to share. Like I will say, if there's like a group conversation going on and there is something I can share, but I'm just like, but this is just to share. It doesn't really provide value. I'll usually like opt out of it, but I've had pretty great experiences. So I think I can still provide value. And sometimes I do this with Adam, but we end up having these conversations and I'll just press record and I'll know that like at some point or another, I'll be able to transcribe this. But sometimes in conversation, I said divine because I really believe it. I believe that creativity comes from the creator. And so when that comes out, it's like something that is of another world. And I do believe that intentional conversation is a huge part of that. So it's very comforting to hear that from you.
Talk away. It's all part of the
I will
process.
Always. So in your first memoir, Am I There Yet? You talk about this solo trip that you took to Europe in 2017. And while you were in Granada, Spain, which is one of my favorite places in the world, by the way, you unfortunately suddenly came down with this rare illness called Guillain-Barré syndrome. Yep. I think I said that okay.
Yes.
And
yes.
It and it left you not a very chic disease though, and it left you paralyzed, physically paralyzed for 2 months. And the questions that you asked yourself that you wrote about, am I still an artist? Am I still a writer? Because you were not able to use your hands, and you were even taking flamenco classes, and you were wondering if you would ever be able to dance again because I know you are a flamenco enthusiast. What did you learn about who you actually are from the experience of temporarily losing your physical abilities?
That's something I haven't thought about in a while. It's something that I want to come back to because it was really valuable. I learned that my identity is like a loved person, you know, beloved person. And that's like what matter. I mean, there's no way for it not to sound really cliche, but it's like when you truly learn that, it's so transformative. I could not produce anything. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't go to the bathroom. I couldn't feed myself. There was nothing I could do. And we are so obsessed with human doings as opposed to human beings. We don't know what to do with a human who can just be. I've been really interested the past couple of years in how we treat people with severe disabilities, you know, who cannot do the things in society that make money or even make people feel good. I have a friend with a daughter who has a disability that they will never really know if she knows them. You know, they'll never know if she really loves them or recognizes them. And we put so much value on, well, your child makes you happy and you're, you know, it's all worth it for those hugs. And what is it? What is the experience of parenting when your child may not recognize you? Or, you know, what's the value of a person who can't make things? And there are some really big questions that we need to grapple with as a society that we have just put under the rug, like we just pretend don't exist. But in that time when I couldn't do anything, and I also was kind of being a little shit, like I wasn't being a very nice person. I wasn't being like really sweet. I was annoyed. I was angry. I was hard to deal with. And I just really recognize my identity as beloved, and not necessarily of people, but of the divine. And now, like when I start a group chat or something, I'll like refer to people as beloveds. And
I love that word.
It's a beautiful word. It's a beautiful word. And it's, I'm not saying like you're beloved of me, although that's true. I mean, you are beloved. Like your identity is beloved on this earth. Everyone is beloved. And to see people that way, you know, like if I'm in a really bad mood on the subway or something, I'll think, oh, look at all these beloveds, or like, beloveds, get out of my way. And just to kind of see people that way, like you are all loved, you know, to see that as your identity is pretty life changing.
That is so beautiful. And thank you for sharing that story about your friend. I really appreciate that. I love hearing you talk about children because you have a very interesting perspective. You were an only child, so you were your best friend for a long time. You also have spoken about freezing your eggs, and you've also spoken about your friend's experiences with infertility. What do you think our society needs to change about our relationship with quote unquote worthiness around women's bodies being able to be with child?
I was thinking when I released my last book and I had a party for it, I was thinking that like the only celebrations that that women really have like set for them in their life have to do with either finding a partner or procreating. Like we don't have these set party, you know, you go to a million weddings and baby showers. You don't go to a ton of parties recognizing like professional accomplishments. You might go to like a retirement party, but you don't like dream about your retirement party your whole life. So, you know, there's not a lot of like ritual or ceremonies for things that don't have to do with a woman's relationship to someone else. And, you know, it's all about like, oh, you found someone or you made someone, but they're not really about things that you did for yourself. And it all belongs. I'm not saying that people shouldn't celebrate those things. It's just that there are other things that we can also celebrate. And also ritualize and mark and have ceremonies for. I would have loved a ceremony when I froze my eggs. It was a really isolating experience. I remember walking around the East Village. It's so funny. Like when you freeze your eggs, you kind of feel like Mother Goose. It's like all of these, you know, you're like so heavy. And I kind of felt like I was carrying around like this little basket of children or something. And it was so funny. I was like walking around thinking, nobody knows this about me. Like, no one here can see what's going on with me. And it felt really lonely. And it would have been nice to have, like, my friend Jumana, who did that many times for IVF, she, like, called me during my last shot, which was so sweet, and, like, did a toast for me and, like, made it this kind of beautiful ritual and ceremony. And I thought, God, that's what we need. Like, we need these rituals to mark these things that might seem kind of shameful or isolating.
We just have to do that for ourselves. Like, we just have to make – I mean, if you – through a party for when you froze your eggs, I would have 100% been there. I would have been like, yes.
So I'd be like on Absolutely. My couch, people around me, like feeding me.
Totally. Yes. Isn't that That'd what a party amazing. Should be like?
Yes.
Yeah. I love that idea. So you met a chaplain while you were in Granada, while you were in the hospital, and he shared a story with you of himself becoming ill during a travel, and you said it felt like a life raft. How did this encounter with this chaplain stick with you so much so that you are now a hospital chaplain yourself?
Well, I think like a lot of people, I thought a chaplain comes to you when you're about to die. So as soon as I saw this guy coming in, you know, this part of Spain is really traditional, a lot of Muslims, a lot of Catholics, and they're both super old school in southern Spain, really, really traditional, conservative. And so I'm in this hospital, this like super old school looking guy comes in my room with like a rosary and a priest collar. And I was like, oh, I'm about to die. Like, that's why he's here. You know, like you think he's like giving me my last rites or something. Like, I don't know what he's going to do. I didn't know until he started talking that he was just there for emotional support. I didn't really know what a chaplain was. And That's what he said to me when he first met me. He was so, he just radiated love. Like, I saw God in him. And he said, I'm not here for any reason except to be your friend. Like, I know, you know, there's not a lot of humanity in this place. And I'm here just to chat. And he just chatted. I don't even know if he prayed for me or anything. He just talked. And he, now I know as a chaplain, we're not really encouraged to do this, but he shared a story from his own life that I found a lot of resonance with. And I kind of felt like, oh, there's like something about me that you understand. And so I am on this path of chaplaincy, which is essentially, I mean, it's so basic. It's like bringing humanity into places where there's not a lot of, you know, like prisons. I would actually love to be a prison chaplain ultimately. And these are spaces where there's not a lot of care for the human soul. There's not a lot of care for the spirit. It's a neglected part of a person. And so to bring that and just talk and just say, what's going on today? That's what I always ask when I go into hospital rooms is like, what's going on? Tell me how are you doing? And I might say a prayer, I might not. I'm learning a lot of different prayers right now that I can, you know, do with people, but that's not really the point. The point is to be a buddy. So that's been really special.
Why did you pick this profession, this new profession on your list of all these amazing different things that you've gotten to try in life?
Because I hadn't done it yet. And all my work was canceled in 2020. And I was like, what else could I do? Oh, yeah, I remember. I remember having this great experience. And I've always been really interested in suffering and death from a spiritual perspective. And this is something I think Muslims do incredibly well, something that Christians don't do as well, or I would say contemporary American Christians don't do as well, is really acknowledge suffering and death as a part of life and ritualize that and sit with that. It's something that we kind of pretend doesn't happen. And I've always been quite comfortable with it, actually, as a very real part of life. So to get to like...
It's the only thing that happens to all of us.
Right. I mean, 100%.
It's like the chance. One thing we have in common, 100%.
It will happen. Everyone you know, including you, will die. It's coming for you someday, hopefully in 300 years, but it will happen. And we kind of pretend it doesn't exist. And we have like one rigid way to mark it. And I really fascinated with some other ways that we can do that. So that's what I'm exploring right now.
What is the biggest thing that you've learned so far, especially because you are picking this up during a pandemic?
Yeah, I think it's something that I'm relearning, which is never stops being surprising, is that there can be so much joy in the midst of grief and sorrow. I've met with people who are very close to death, and they still like really want to hear about me, or you know, they want to talk about silly things, or they want to laugh, they want to joke around. And it's like, wow, you don't have that many days left here, and you're choosing to spend this time like making jokes, and there's still laughter to be had, and I wish that we would, you know, allow for those emotions to tangle up with each other really beautifully, as opposed to like, this has to be this extremely solemn event with like no smiles whatsoever.
That's so beautiful. I have some rapid fire questions for you.
Oh my gosh,
and then a final question.
Go for it.
I think we've been talking for a really long time, but I love it.
I love it too.
And thank you so much for sticking around.
My God, my pleasure.
Who is an author that has changed your life?
Ooh, the theologian Frederick Buechner, because he writes about the beauty in the ordinary.
Ooh,
my favorite
thing. Love it.
Yeah.
Wow. Favorite book that you've read during the pandemic?
Oh, that's a good one. I just finished Chanel Miller's memoir called Know My Name, which is about her sexual assault and her building her beautiful life after that, and the kind of wonders and challenges of recovering from anything, very universal experience.
I heard that was like a life-changing book.
It's beautiful. She's really observant, which is a great quality in a writer.
Amazing. Your favorite song to dance to?
Oh my gosh, I have so many. I would say All For You, Janet Jackson.
Your favorite song to dance flamenco to?
Ooh, Caminando Por La Calle, I think it's called, by the Gypsy Kings.
Your favorite non-alcoholic beverage?
Oh, great question. I'm really into making a mocktail, a Paloma mocktail, which is seed lip, spice, non-alcoholic liquor, little bit of grapefruit juice, and top it off with toast, which is non-alcoholic carbonated delicious tea beverage, and it's like perfect.
It's so good. I'm also literally have a tab open of seed lip, and I'm so happy that you shared spice because I was trying to figure out which one to get.
Yes. Spice is very cardamomy, if you like that, which
I like cardamom.
So, yeah.
Your go-to bookstore.
Oh, I have this one near my house called Powerhouse, which is so teeny tiny. It has like 5 books, but I love it. It's like it's got everything I need.
I love that. And the local business that you have been supporting the most in New York these days?
Oh my gosh, my local hardware store for sure. I try really hard not to just like order things from Amazon, but to like actually go to a store and buy like a screwdriver or whatever. So yeah, it's doing me well. Good old.
I wasn't going to guess a local hardware store, but I'm very happy that that is
super friendly.
What you're supporting
smells good. Yeah.
Okay, so I ask all of my guests the final question: what do you know for sure?
I know for sure that there is beauty to be found in every life experience. And by beauty, I don't mean happiness or pretty things or glamour or even joy. I mean beauty. I mean actual beauty. Beauty comes from the Greek word for calling. And I think a calling is whatever is grabbing our attention. So in every life experience, if you pay attention to it, you will find beauty. And that's what I know. I also know that spice is really good.
How can our listeners and viewers support you right now?
Oh, I would love to share my book with them. It's called My Inner Sky, available wherever books are sold. You can find me over at Instagram at @bymariandrew, and that's where I share my scrapbook.
Is there a favorite bookstore that you want people to purchase Inner Sky from?
Ooh, yes. I have so many, but there's a great one in D.C. in Petworth called Loyalty Bookstore. It's a Black woman-owned bookstore that's very dear to my heart, and that would be a great one.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Mari. Thanks for always just like being such a great light. This was so fun.
Ah, delightful. Delightful. I want to spend every set. What is today? Friday. Is today Friday? Yes. Friday
yes,
morning with
Friday.
You. Who knows? Every
yes.
morning. I could just do this. Drink my coffee with you. Coffee with Nora time.
Let's do it.
I hope you enjoyed the storytelling session with Mari Andrew. You can follow her on Instagram at @bymari, that's M-A-R-I, Andrew, and pick up her 2 books, Am I There Yet?, and her latest, My Inner Sky, wherever you get your books. She also has a creative workshop you can take on Skillshare. If you'd like to watch the video version of this podcast, it is up on YouTube or Facebook, both/Noor. And to you, our listener, I want to thank you for your listen and support. I'd love to stay connected. Here are some ways I'm telling stories these days. You can text me if you are in the US or Canada. Yes, it is me, not a bot. I also text you intentional daily questions of the day. My number is 301-246-8894. You can follow us on social, on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and YouTube @Noor. And on Instagram @AYS. My Twitter, Snapchat, and Clubhouse is N Tagori.